My name is Cynthia. I grew up in Baltimore County, and from the moment that I was born, I was obsessed with pop culture. So I did everything I could to try to get myself into it, knowing that I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't do any of the talents that you would want to see on camera. Exactly. But what I could do was write. At least I thought I could. I got into journalism. I went to a summer camp at Northwestern University when I was a junior in high school, the Medill Northwestern Journalism Institute, and I fell in love with it. And that's what I decided to do. I went there to Northwestern for my undergraduate degree, and I got a job at People Magazine in 1993. At that point, I started my career, which was really wonderful, having a chance to report on different kinds of people and topics. I covered Olympics, I covered television, I covered music, but of course, the biggest thing that I was able to cover was the show Survivor.
Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin. At Wheel With It, we are dedicated to exploring DEI issues in a fair, balanced, and fun way. Let's get into the episode.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. And today, my inner eight-year-old Survivor-obsessed fan in me is freaking out because we have Cynthia here, and I'm going to let her tell you who she is. But Cynthia, welcome to Wheel With It.
Hi, Devin. Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, tell us about yourself and why my eight-year-old inner Survivor fan is freaking out, and then we'll get started.
My name is Cynthia. I grew up in Baltimore County, and from the moment that I was born, I was obsessed with pop culture. So I did everything I could to try to get myself into it, knowing that I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't do any of the talents that you would want to see on camera. Exactly. But what I could do was write. At least I thought I could. I got into journalism. I went to a summer camp at Northwestern University when I was a junior in high school, the Medill Northwestern Journalism Institute, and I fell in love with it. And that's what I decided to do. I went there to Northwestern for my undergraduate degree, and I got a job at People Magazine in 1993. At that point, I started my career, which was really wonderful, having a chance to report on different kinds of people and topics. I covered Olympics, I covered television, I covered music. But of course, the biggest thing that I was able to cover was the show Survivor. Out of Los Angeles, and I went onto my first location for All Stars season 8. And from that point on, you pretty much could not get me away from the series.
Yes, I've been watching it for 20 years. I know how you feel.
It's really compelling, isn't it?
It's
not just a reality show. It's not just a game show, even though Jeff Probst would not want it to be referred to that way. But it is something that speaks to a lot of different things that people feel and want to experience. And it's interesting to see it on the ground, which I had a chance to do. And from that, it made me even more appreciative of the show. I spent many years covering it.
Why does Probst not want it referred to as a game show? Because as a fan, I tend to think of it as more of a game show. Because when you think of reality TV, you think a bunch of people fighting and pulling each other's hair out and all that stuff. And that's not what's, of course, they've had their moments in the past, but that's usually not what Survivor is. It is more of a game show with strategy and everything.
There are those elements in there, and you can't deny that people are playing for $1 million. But I think what Jeff really appreciated about the show from the very beginning was the social element of it, and that it is a social experiment on many levels. You do have people who've not met each other meeting together for the first time in a very dire circumstance. They're out on an island, and it is true. They have meager supplies. They do have to get along very quickly, and you have to do that when you're hangry. You have to do that when
I just like zone out when I'm hungry, but my dad would, I don't think he thinks it's entirely real, which is hilarious to me because I've been watching it for 20 years. My dad would, once he figured out there was no sandwiches between scenes, I think he'd go crazy.
One of the best contestants ever on Survivor, Ciri Fields, also thought as soon as she got on the island, they were going to have umbrellas, people were going to bring them water, that surely they can't just throw you onto an island. But she found out that nope, when the producers left, there she was, and then you really had to play the game.
Yes, and we will get to Ciri in a minute, because have you been watching Big Brother this season?
I haven't had the pleasure, but I hear it's very interesting.
It's very good. I won't ask you your opinion on her son then, because okay. You have not had the opportunity of watching it. He's a good kid, and I had the privilege of interacting with Ciri for a few minutes on a Zoom call for some charity Zoom event she was doing. And she really is that nice in person. Oh my gosh.
Yes. So
can you give a good early probe story?
Sure. How early did you want the stories to be?
You would be changed your first season to your last season, I guess is a better way to put it.
Sure. Very much when he started working on Survivor, it was a job. It was granted, it was very exciting because you got to travel overseas. You were working in different circumstances, but he had just come off of hosting Celebrity Rock and Roll Jeopardy. And so that's a very different kind of show, right? You're in a studio, it's very much a patter back and forth between you and a contestant, and then you go home at the end of the day. So this was a completely different thing. And Mark Burnett had asked him to just come on location and to just off the cuff, go for it. Announce what you think the show is about. And when he really thought about it, he said, this is a different kind of show. And when he observed the first cast on location in Borneo, he thought this could be something bigger. But granted, at the time, he was still very much a host. In a traditional sense, he was hired talent. He viewed himself that way. But I think as the years have gone on, you've seen that confidence in his ability to own the things that he says.
Oh, yeah. I started watching him when I was a little kid, he's the one that made me want to get into this industry in the first place. So as a little kid, I just thought he was the coolest thing ever. So a lot of it went over my head. But now as an adult, I can definitely see, yeah, he's definitely owned it more now than he did in the early seasons.
Yes. And I think also early on, they had no idea how long the show would last. Each period of time he went up for his contract renewal, he was young in his career and he thought there might be other opportunities for me. As you may know, he also had done his own talk show.
I remember running home from school my junior year of high school to watch the premiere of that, even though I wasn't watching Survivor at the time, because not that I didn't like the show, but I couldn't breathe because I had all honors, but I still made time to watch the premiere of the Jeff Probst show.
That was part of him fulfilling his dream of really relating to people on a different level and telling different kinds of stories. And he had done that as a fill-in host with Live with Kelly Ripa and everything in New York. So he was torn, I think, between wanting a career, traditional career in a city, as opposed to wandering around the world. But I think when he realized this show has legs, this show really will be able to live on, he wanted to have more of a producer role where he can talk about what fans wanted. He can talk about what he wanted or how he viewed the show should be. And when you give someone who's normally on air the ability to also affect decisions behind the scenes, then that is a dynamic that I think he couldn't resist. And I'm sure fans agree that's been a wonderful thing to see evolve from him.
Yes, most of them I think would. Some of them wouldn't, but most of them would.
There are always going to be people who are going to. I wonder if he has too much power, but I think he really understands and he's trying to do his best to keep the show.
No, I've seen people with too much power and Probst is not. I've seen people power drunk and Probst is not power drunk at all. First of all, I'm going to ask you this. Probst, and you can answer this any way you want to. I don't think any recipe. Probst is the best we've ever seen as far as show running and producing, or do you think there are better people out there?
I think he's definitely one of the best we've seen. It's difficult to juggle both roles, But I think what's been extraordinary is I don't think people realize that when he's on location, he doesn't have a script. He's not listening to anyone in the ear to tell him what to say.
And I've always believed that. And there are people that are like, oh, he's got an earpiece in. I was joking around with my dad. I said, I learned, this is not me being funny or flattering. This is true. I learned my interview skills from watching Jeff for about 20 years. That's the primary way I learned how to interview. If somebody gave me an earpiece, I wouldn't know what to do because I learned how to do it without an earpiece.
He's learned that the best way to elicit a good reaction is to be spontaneous and to really listen. And I think that's the difference between him and some other hosts. You have an idea that he's really paying attention to things around him and to respect what people are experiencing and saying. And that empathy is also something that's grown with him. He's told me that since he's had a family and he's had children in his life, he really now understands the loved one's visit. Whereas before he thought, oh, this is a segment that we do. It's a reward for people. I don't really understand why they're crying and jumping up and down and being very excited about this. But now that he has his children, he really sees why it's important for people to have that cathartic moment. And this is the empathy he's learned along the way. I do think that's why he's such an extraordinary host and producer for acknowledging that people do think this is important.
Can you tell us about his wife and children, Nini? Because first of all, the one little clip I've seen of his wife when she co-hosted Probst, she seems like she's hysterical. And I just want to know about his wife and kids. Can you give us as much as you're comfortable with giving?
I've met Lisa before, and she is absolutely wonderful. I think what is genuine between them. You're talking about people who've met a bit older in life, and they've had a lot of their own experiences. And I think when you shed that away and you get down to, is this someone that I want to talk to, spend time with, I enjoy? That's what you find so companionable about the two of them together. I think they make an environment that's very fun for their kids. I think their kids have grown up wanting adventure, and being able to be on location is certainly very exciting. You're not just walking on a beach. You're actively testing out challenges and doing the kind of things that make you want to see more. And now you're seeing the children grow up a little older and wanting to get into production. So like you, I think they see the experience on the show and decide this is something that will be fulfilling. And I think you're talking about parents who nurture that.
Yes. And you might not want to get too much into this either, but I admired the whole season 39 debacle, which we won't get in too much into. As much as I love him, as most people did, disagreed with how he handled that. Okay.
Right.
But I didn't, the hate and the vitriol that was spewed online, it was like nothing I've ever seen. I'm like, I don't know how he and his wife are standing up under this. So you would have to have a strong foundation to be able to stand up under that, I would think.
Right. It's also about learning as you go again. And you would think that by season 39, Jeff and everyone on the show will have seen everything, you know, encountered everything. But there are things that happen that you don't necessarily predict and you don't know how to roll with. And that's part of it. I think part of it is the contrition of him learning this is something that we can handle differently. This is something we can do differently. And it's difficult when you're in the thick of it and you're producing a show and you're in isolation, you're on location, and to see how that will play out. They've seen it work successfully in the past with other similar incidents. But when it comes to what we do now, that's what you're going to be judged on ultimately. How does this change for season 40, 41, 42, and onward? And I think the reaction, as you can tell now, with the diversity of the cast, with the inclusion that they have, has made the show leap in a whole other direction.
Which, I mean, and they now have psychologists. They have always had psychologists, but additional psychologists and an investigator. So that now they have all the safeguards in place. But from being in the advocacy, I knew exactly what he should have done. But Jeff's not in that you can only go off what you know. So.
And there was a lot of education, I will have to say. There was a lot of discussions that he and the producers had with other contestants from the past, with experts in the field, with executives who decided there are ways that we can do this and still be true to what you know and still be true to the crew that you began with. And I think to be able to fuse what, you know, they've learned along the way with new information, that's what has made the show better. And I think he would say has made him better.
And the way he handled it at the finale, amazing. The way he handled that at the finale was just amazing. And I don't know if most showrunners could come back from something like that. And for him to do that was just amazing.
I think it helped that you had Winners at War following it. So you did have a bit of a pause where now you're dealing with a show with people very familiar with how the game is and how it's played. And then during the pandemic, you have a lot of time to think, what can we do going forward? What will the show look like? What steps can we take to make a change? And because now after 20 years, this will be the next phase. And so in some ways, there was a good natural built-in pause for the show to really think about what they wanted to do.
Okay, I completely forgot where I was. I'm like, I'm going to go somewhere. I completely forgot where I was going. So tell us about the retrospective book and how that came about. Was that something you wanted to do or CBS wanted to do? Or
I would always love to write about Survivor anytime I can get a chance to do it. But it came about from an opportunity from CBS, an outside partner they had for publishing. It was great because, again, we're all on hold in our lives in 2020. And they thought, you know what, you've experienced and you've seen so much, you may want to be able to distill this and put this together in a document of some sort. What would you want to do? What kind of book would you want to have? And I've spoke with some previous contestants about what they would want to see. For instance, Kobe Archa from Survivor Palau, he had always said, I want all players to be acknowledged some way, not just people who have won the game, but others who may have had their lives affected by the game. I heard from production that it'd be great if people could see what I do. For example, you have Dax Poynton who does the art direction. It'd be wonderful if people can see how we make a snuffer, how we set up tribal council. So with all of these voices, that's where I started. And I said, you know what, if you want to put together a book, I would love to do that. And so it was about a year and a half of doing a lot of interviews and rewatching those seasons that we love and really figuring out this might be something that a fan would like. And you have a lot of resources available online and a lot of wonderful blogs and a lot of people who have followed the show for a long time. And you have Rob Cesternino who does an incredible
podcast. Oh my gosh. He,
right?
Isn't Rob Cesternino a gift to this community? I'm sorry.
Yes.
He's such a gift to this community. Oh my gosh. And hilarious too.
He's hilarious. He's knowledgeable. He's enthusiastic. He's everything that you want in someone who was a fan going into his season and coming out of it. And I met him for the first time on All Stars. And it was really great to see him go from that stage of his career to what he's been doing now for all the reality community, in addition to Survivor. But yes, between him and Stephen Fishbach, who I knew originally from Token Cheats, working with them, I said, you know what, I want you guys to be involved because you analyze the show all the time. Now sit back and really bring it home for us. Now you can see each season in whole. What do you think about it? The developments in the gameplay, the developments in how it's shot and what Jeff has been doing. What new things have the contestants been bringing in every season? So you take all of that, and that's what I poured into the book, which has now been out in digital form. And we've been hoping to get it out in physical print form, but paper costs have been very expensive. And so we're just seeing what we can do, but at least it's out.
Fingers are crossed. Fingers are way crossed. Maybe we can start a petition on change.org or something, like get this out in print.
Definitely, if fans want it in physical form, let CBS know, because they definitely were supportive of it. They were worried about how can we mass produce this, because it's quite heavy. It's quite big. I ended up writing about 274 large magazine pages on the series and doing 90 interviews. So it was quite an endeavor.
How long did it take you to compile all of that? Because my friends joke on me about how big a fan I am of Pops and Survivor, but there's stuff in there, and I'm slowly skimming my way through it. There's some stuff in there I didn't even know or think about. So how long did it take you to put that together?
We wanted to complete it in the year 2020, obviously, to be out in 2021, but we couldn't do that. But that afforded me more time. So I was able to conduct interviews with people where the interviews themselves were much longer. They're usually between 15 minutes to half an hour and more per person that I spoke to. And I think when you do that, it really, you decide, okay, I can have that as a Q&A, or, oh, this person can speak to this other chapter of the book. So it allowed me to have more time to consider what I wanted to do, what we wanted to say. And also to include people from different games. I've covered Survivor Australia, so it was wonderful to have people who I've met here be part of the book. So that all came when you have more time. So I would say about a year and a half it took.
So is that why did you make the move to Australia? Was it a career move or was it a personal move?
Devin, you're going to love this story. I met my husband on location on Survivor Vanuatu.
Yes, I remember reading that somewhere now that you say that.
Yes, he was doing sound for E! Entertainment. So he was part of the press corps and I was with People at the time. And in the beginning, you would have these junkets where you would be out for 8 days. And what they would do is you could observe the cold open, or you talk to contestants first, you tour tribal council,
That don't know, the cold open is like on the premiere episode when you see them like coming up on the boat.
Yes. Yes. Okay. You observe that. And then you observe an hour on each tribe beach just to see how they're settling in. You could have the option of testing out a challenge with a dream team if you wanted to. And then you just spend the time getting to know culturally the environment that you're in, meeting with people who are in different parts of the island or location that you're at. And you do this over the span of 8 days. So it was during our time in Vanuatu that I met my husband. And so you would never expect a long distance relationship to carry, certainly did for us.
Yes.
So that's why he's from Australia.
I've had some bad luck with long distance relationships. So I'm glad it worked out better for you. Yeah. So how did you guys maintain through the distance? Because it's one thing to be in a different state. It's another thing to be in a different. Were you both in the US at the time or no?
No, he was back in Sydney and I was in Los Angeles. And actually I had good advice from a coworker of mine who at the time was engaged to a musician who was from Wales. And she advised that for a successful long distance relationship, you need to talk to someone on the phone every day, even if it's just 2 minutes, even if you have nothing to say except hello, goodbye. She said that the voice connection is really important. So not texting, not any of that, just talk to someone. And for the months that we did that, I think you learn more about someone. So you learn that without being close to someone, you just learn and you listen to the voice and that comfort comes through. So when we got back together, I think we just knew all sorts of things about each other already. And I think that was really wonderful. And certainly we were helped along by the Survivor crew who knew that it was something special that we met on that show.
Were any of the Survivor crew at y'all's wedding or did you just keep it family friends? You don't have to answer that if you don't want to.
No, we kept it mostly the family friends, but Jeff, to his credit, had offered to officiate as he is ordained.
Yes, he is.
He hadn't do that, but of course he was filming at the time and we needed to proceed with our wedding when we did, but he was very generous in being willing to do that for us. So it goes to show you another aspect of Jeff, that he cares about the people who are surrounding him. Certainly people who were producers on the show, on the CBS side, or PR representatives that I've met along the way were at the wedding, and fellow reporters who cover the show were at the wedding too.
Do you have a favorite Survivor contestant? We'll start there. And then...
That's hard to answer, because as there are a lot of people who I've gotten to know over the years, and I don't think they would want me to single out one person or another. But I will have to say, at least a special contestant for me was Yul Kwan, in the sense that for me to see, you know, Asian win Survivor was very important. He had a very difficult time dealing with a lot of what went into being on the show. He wasn't as familiar with the format when he landed in Cook Islands. And to learn that the show was going to hinge on race was not what he expected at all. So you're dealing with someone who is playing the game for the first time, is now thrust in a situation where he felt an obligation to represent his community in the best light possible. So he and Becky Lee definitely teamed together to do that. And that's extraordinary. It's one thing to survive and worry about winning this game and doing your best. It's another to also have something so big on your shoulders as he did. And I think—
Yes, which is what impressed me so much about Noah and Ryan in 43, is they played a very strategic game and were very excellent, especially Noel. Excellent representations for the disability community as well. And I know what it's like to be the only kind of person in the room and have to do your job, plus be a good representation to your community. And people could say, oh, there's that Survivor again, being all dramatic. It is a very tough thing to shoulder, knowing that you are basically the sole representation of an entire community and the entire planet is going to be watching you. It's just insane.
It is. I think he handled himself incredibly well, and that he was friends with Oscar, he was friends with the people who made, you know, that possible, is incredible. I think that's why you still see that bond, even with quote unquote villain Jonathan Penner in that season. They got along because there was just an understanding and a respect for what was being done. And how that show then changed the conversation for future editions of Survivor. Very, just an extraordinary person.
Why do you think that they decided, and I genuinely want to know, but why do you think they decided to divide by race for that season? Was it just a experiment type of thing, or were they trying to make a statement, or?
I don't think it was anything that profound. I think it was just, this is something different. We've not had this sort of arrangement before. Let's see if it works. I don't think in the time, in the broader media, there wasn't a sort of viewing of it as, well, this will be very controversial, or that this is necessarily wrong, until it aired. And then when people reacted to it, they were like, no, why are you doing this? Did anyone think about this? And I think that gave them a lot of pause. But again, the happy accident of it, if you wanted to say, is that it did bring contestants onto the show that we had not seen. And it created a different dynamic, and I would say a better dynamic on air, with how people responded. And to just see representation on the show was a spark, and it made things different going forward, made us more open and accepting of the idea that you need to broaden the scope of the people that you welcome onto the series. And I think they really took that to heart.
Speaking of contestants, Eric Wakenbart is somebody you undoubtedly interviewed for the book, even though I haven't gotten to. How did he strike you? And did he have a sense of humor about the whole thing of what went down in Micronesia?
Eric's incredible. Yes, I had interviewed him at the time that he came off his series in Micronesia, but it was reconnecting with him to talk about the Black Widow Brigade and his experience with it now was extraordinary. He had just done the oral history with Dalton Ross of Entertainment Weekly of what it was like to experience that. I had just interviewed both Ceree, Amanda, and Parvati about how they formed the Black Widow Brigade and what that was all about, but to hear his view of it was really nice. I think what you're going to find interesting about Eric is he truly took what could have been an infamous situation and made it his own now. He says, if you go back, especially when Micronesia came on Netflix, if you go back and watch it, he said, look, it holds up really well. It's a memorable moment. I was part of history. I was part of a really exciting tribal council. And he wants to view it that way. But you can't take away that I was a very young man at the time who wanted to make a move. And they gave me an opportunity to really be a hero if I did it. And you've just got people thinking at different levels compared to where he was. But it was a teaching lesson for him.
He didn't say, because I know that there's been some speculation on Reddit and whatever. I don't include the online forums that much after 39, but on Reddit and whatever, that he did it because he had feelings. He might have had feelings for, I mean, they don't say exactly this, but he might have had feelings for Amanda, Natalie, or whoever. That didn't factor into it at all.
I think, first of all, you have to be starstruck that you're playing with people of this caliber.
With three freaking fields. The minute three walked up on that beach, I'd be done.
You would think that each time she's come, that someone would say, you know what, we need to eliminate this threat, but they don't. So we'll get to that in a minute. I think with Eric though, yes. I don't know if he was necessarily having a crush on Amanda or any of the players, but I definitely know you're starstruck. And he definitely was starstruck by them. And the idea that they're encouraging me to make a move that could elevate me to a level that they're on, I think that's just too much temptation. He was in his early 20s and you really playing for the first time. And you're, again, we talk about being starved and not thinking quite right. You really want to do what you think is going to further what the jury is going to think about you. And he definitely
imagine if it had worked. And they had voted out Amanda, whoever they were supposed to vote out, then we would say he was the best strategist in Survivor history. So
it's all a risk because you're working with imperfect information. You're only working with what you're being told, and you have to then trust if that information is going to help you or hurt you. And I think he was very trusting. He knows that now. He was very young and trusting, but you can't change that. And he wouldn't for the world. We've since gone on and worked together. He is an illustrator by profession.
Yes, I've ordered one of his comics. He's a genius. He's awesome.
Yes. In my capacity of managing magazines, he's come aboard as an illustrator for works that I've done. So it's great to know people and get to relate with them away from the series. And he's definitely one of them. I do think he has a healthy perspective on what happened in Micronesia. And he actually encourages people to tune in and see if they view it differently now.
Yeah, it makes me cringe to watch it every time. But as I thought about it, I view it so differently now because me, the, I don't know how old I was, 14-year-old watching it, I'd be like, that dude's so crazy. Like, why would he do that? And then now I think, okay, you're 20 something. You have four women, three of which are, and he said this, very good looking, coming yes. and saying, give this title up and you're starved. There's no way. I would just be like, okay, here.
Think about it. Each one of these contestants is formidable enough on their own. You're talking about people who are very persuasive and can behave that way around you on their own. Now you've got three of them just piling on top of you. It's going to be very intimidating for anyone to go against what they're asking you. He was in a very vulnerable spot.
Yeah, if that was... We all seem to think, oh, I would have done that if I was him. But looking back now, if I was 20 and I was, as we all are, very immature at 20. And right. So now looking back, if I was 20 and I was Eric, no, I would be done.
Yes, I think the way you're viewing it now is exactly how people should view the situation. at the age that he was at, in it being a first-time player against veteran players, even with Natalie being a first-time player, she still had an edge wisdom-wise on Eric. It makes a big difference, and it will change your perspective on how that all happened. But it really makes for good television.
Yes. And when you've got Saree Fields guiding you, I think you have an edge wisdom-wise on everybody.
Yes. Saree, just absolutely incredible. Met her for the first time on Panama Exile Island. She had no idea what she was doing. She didn't know where she was really and how she would end up. But you saw her confidence grow throughout that season. She started to understand what the elements of the game were, how she needed to respond to each situation. And but for a fire challenge, I think she would have been hard to beat. And again,
she's had some of the worst and best luck in Survivor history, because she was on a podcast with Rob and he was like, you've had some of the worst luck in Survivor history, haven't you? And she goes, and some of the best, because I was supposed to be the first one to go home. And I hadn't even remembered that. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, she does too.
And she survived that vote in Exile Island because she was that much more friendly and likable in camp. So that is her strength too. Her relatability kept her in the game. And then she used it to further herself in the game. She became a mother figure to ours. She became whatever you needed her to be, that's what she was going to be. And that's what propelled her to get as far as she did on Exile Island. And then you saw on Micronesia, that was her probably at her full powers in terms of persuasion and the ability to last. But for a situation of injury where you now have a final two instead of a final three, if you had a final three, I have no doubt Saree would have won.
Saree would have won. Yes. And what went through your mind? You watched, I know she said that Micronesia was one of the most devastating of her losses, but again, I didn't even remember that because I was 14 back then and it's been a number of years. But when you watch Game Changers, what went through your mind at that tribal council? Were you just as shocked as we all were?
I think it was all building up to something like that happening. I think I was cringing as the episode unfolded. And it was set up, as Jeff has told me, by they were just so excited about introducing all of these, what he calls these weapons, right? These tools that you can use. And seeing them use. So on some level, he was thrilled that all of the tools that they threw into the game were being deployed in the way that they were supposed to. What he didn't expect is that they would happen when you get down so close to the end of the game, to the point where Saree is frozen out because she just simply didn't have an advantage to play. She's told me that, look, since there was absolutely nothing she could do about the situation, it was interesting that she went out that way.
Where you can look back and say, because usually you can pinpoint, even if you don't know it at the time, and you should have made that decision at the time because you didn't know what was coming 6 months later. But there's a rare occurrence where you can look back and say, I could have done nothing. And that is there was literally nothing she could do.
No, there wasn't. And so that's why I think she told me anyway that she was okay with that departure, because it was completely out of her hands. If it's something she could control, then yes, then she would be upset if she were to leave because of that. Her worst outing was Heroes versus Villains, and in her mind, she didn't have full control of that, and she would own up to that. I think what in her game is the ability to just read people so well. We hear people talk about that, but she actually does it, and she's brilliant.
She's even on Big Brother. She had picked up on this, that you watch her and you're like, okay, I'm sitting here at home watching this. I'm not even picking up on it. She's guiding me through this. And I'm sitting here with all the information and with the live feeds. And not that I watched the live feeds that much, but with the live feeds and the Reddit threads and the podcast and I don't even pick up all these things. And here she is in the game going, okay, it's incredible.
It is. And it's really difficult for people to know that when you're out there on the island, you're not writing things down. This is all by memory, observation, and retaining in your head all the conversations that you've had, all the schemes that you've put in place, reacting to how people are presenting themselves to you and what you can do with that. She's brilliant at that. And what I think was also interesting is that she told me in the course of doing the book that, you know what, it doesn't matter what they change in the game. It doesn't matter the rules that change, the people that she's playing with, they're different. She said, put me on the island at any given time. I guarantee you, yes, I will not be voted off first. Guaranteed.
Guaranteed. Because she's so darn likable. You know she's a threat, but you almost want her around because she's so darn funny.
And people don't consider Sandra, quote unquote, likable in the way that Suri is, but she also is someone who will guarantee that she will not be voted off first. You're talking very savvy players who know exactly what to do. And when you are on that island and you think, oh, I am going to get rid of that person first, they will convince you not to. Absolutely.
If a lot of people listen to this, they're going to be like, you're an idiot. But I wouldn't get that one up to me either, because you can either vote the preeminent strategist pretty much of all time, at least survivor-wise, out first and then get voted out second, or you can use her as a shield and go forward. Like
but it's to everyone's peril, right? What they can use. If you're using Boston Rob as a shield, if you're using Tony as a shield, you have to be very careful, because in the end, they're probably going to outthink you at some stage.
I don't know. I like to think, but this is from eating food on my couch, so this probably wouldn't go too well. But I'd like to think that I've been watching and analyzing strategy for enough that I could attempt to outthink Suri, but it would be an attempt. I'm not going to be cocky enough to guarantee that, oh, I could beat Suri. No, I wouldn't do that. But I would have fun attempting to outthink her, but...
Right. She definitely has given us new perspectives on the game. Her 3-2-1 split, thinking about how to calculate the numbers so that you don't necessarily have to get everyone's vote, you know, that you need to only get what you need per tribal. That kind of thinking did not come into play until she played. So that's incredible. That's how the game evolves. Each person comes in with something different that you may not have considered before. That's another fun thing. I think the reason this game lasts is because you have people thinking on the fly and adapting to what they're being presented.
Yeah. Jeff, in an interview, said that Suri would never win. So do you think they're going to bring Suri back? Or do you think that was just an assumption on Jeff's part?
I would have to disagree with Jeff there. I think that's an assumption on his part. I think it doesn't matter how much you know someone's game. That's why you have 2-2-time winners, correct? Clearly, that's possible. Is it possible for a third-time winner? If you bring Tony back again, could he possibly win? I would have to say the odds are in their favor. What Earl Cole told me was that you cannot view a return game in the same way. It's not a matter of using the same strategy or using a different strategy. It's playing with the people you have at the moment that you have. So anyone with the mentality to do that will get far, if not win the next outing that they're in. You saw that with Sarah Lucina. You saw that with people who, when they come back, and it's playing with the group that you've got.
Yes, and each game is different because each group is different. So you can't say, oh, because I did this last season, it'll work this season, because it's a different group of people.
Although the caveat to that is, as Jonathan Penner told me, if someone perceives you as a villain, whatever you do to go against that, you've got to be very, very careful. Because if you were so much identified with one type of personality and you come in a 180 and try to do something completely different, well, that's going to make you more suspicious. If you're going to change up your strategy, you need to do it in a more subtle fashion than he had tried to do.
Yes. First of all, how do you remember all these seasons? Because I'm a super fan and I don't even think I remember all these moments. So good for you.
And thanks. Well, earlier seasons, the active part of what I covered was definitely that pre-season 20.
Oh, you covered it. I was just joking. You covered it. That's how you remember all this. But I'm like, wow. You brought up stuff. I'm like, okay, I trust her because she covers the show. But I don't remember it, but okay.
But you will when you rewatch particular favorite episodes, great moments of Tribal Council, they will all come flooding back to you.
Once you rewatch it, you're like, oh yeah, that's what happens here. Another question before our last question, if you don't want to add anything. Do you want to add anything?
Oh no, please go ahead. Anything you want to know.
Season 34, Zeke gets outed.
Yes.
How did you see this? What were the behind the scenes of, Jeff handled that masterfully, by the way. What were the behind the scenes of how they handled that and everything? And what was Jeff's mindset, I would guess, going into the airing?
You don't know what's going to happen at Tribal. He's always said that Tribal is very live, but it's usually longer than what on television. So sometimes Tribal Council can go on for 2 hours or more.
Well, what is the longest Tribal Council that you've been at?
I've never had a chance to be at a final Tribal, but I've observed a Tribal Council and they do go on for a while. And I think the reason they do that is manyfold. They're doing it for camera blocking. They're doing it for people to express their stories. I did see the first Tribal on Winners at War. It took a while. I would say you want everyone.
Do they do that because of technical reasons? Like they have to change tape or whatever? Or do they do that because everybody has to have a fair shake?
I think you want people to have a fair shake. People do have a lot to say, but there's also a lot of things happening behind the scenes. You want to make sure that you're capturing the moment in the right way. If someone said something important, but you didn't quite hear it, they want to reposition it in a way, but it's pretty much live, it's flowing, it's happening, and no one knows what people are going to react to, what people are going to say. So it's an interesting situation. I think what you had with Zeke was just shock. I don't think anyone at that Tribal Council, I don't think even Jeff Varner knew exactly what he was saying. It was just, he was in a desperate situation. So he threw out some knowledge that he had that no one else knew he had. And you can see the instant regret that he had as soon as it came out, but it's too late. You've done something where, you know, especially he's part of the community too. So the sensitivity there was, it was devastating, I think, for all parties. And I think Zeke would say now as well that it was just, it was especially difficult knowing it was coming from someone who meant well, ultimately, but it's hard. And I think what Jeff kicked in was that instinct of his to say, I'm a human first.
That empathy instinct that I've never seen in anybody. I've never seen a human being have as much empathy as Jeff Probst does. And that's it, besides my parents and my grandmother. But besides that, I've never seen a human being with more empathy. It's incredible.
It's reacting in the moment, but also reacting as a human being. And this is what I get to when I say about listening. He was hearing the conversation. He was
which I it. Wasn't because I was crying and screaming at the TV. And for him to sit there and be like, okay, he did better than I would have done in that moment.
And the fact that he and the producers gave Zeke agency that, look, we have time before this airs. So what can we do? How can we frame it so that when this is going, when everyone is seeing it, they understand the context of it. They understand what's happening with you in it. Because remember, for months at a time after a show airs, no one really knows the result. And it's you're living the experience of having filmed the show, but no one around you is going to know. And then you have to live it again. I think there's a lot of talking involved in making sure that Zeke knew what was going to happen and what he wanted to have happen.
I've been trying, and I can completely understand wanting to keep his distance from the community after what happened with him, but I've been trying to have Zeke on here since it aired, basically, since his season was over. Do you know anything about how Zeke's doing now?
I don't know. I think he's doing well. I have not been.
I follow him on Instagram, but other than which he doesn't post. So I know he, much. So I know he's engaged.
Yes.
But other than that, and I know he's a writer that writes stupid little comedy things, but other than that.
I mean, that's the best thing. I think the best thing is when you've had a good experience or you've had any experience in the limelight, now you control how much of that limelight you want to keep. It's privacy is an interesting issue, especially now with reality contestants, because they do have much more of a social presence than they did in the past.
Do you know how Chloe Kim is doing?
No, I don't. I know. I wish I knew. But I don't. There are a few that I keep in touch with. And for those, that's been great. Just talking to some older contestants. Well, even Elaine Stott, I've spoken to recently, and she's doing fantastic. I think most people do. I think most people come out of the show with a really good appreciation for that experience. And there's only probably a few for whom it may be very difficult.
There's only a handful that it's been very difficult for. And yes. Which I think speaks to, which you don't see a lot of on other shows. Other shows, it's the other way around. There are only a few positives and the majority of it is difficult. But Survivor, that there are only a few difficults and the majority are positives.
Is it something that you want to experience?
Yes. If I could, I would go out there tomorrow and play the game. But that would definitely be a bucket list. Just to see... Even if it wasn't me, just to see a wheelchair on Survivor would be just amazing. But if there's anybody that can pull it off, it's Jeff and Company. But yes. I'm not sure if they could. I don't expect them to, obviously, but that would be crazy to see a wheelchair out there.
Oh, it would be wonderful. It would be great.
So... Do you think we will ever see wheelchair out there?
We'll see. I think we're going to see, I don't know if necessarily we will. I do hope that they are more inclusive. They certainly have been thinking.
They are, but Ryan and the way they portrayed his CP was awesome, mainly because they didn't speak of it for anybody. Anything but 2 minutes, which is the way we like it. He's a Survivor player first.
Yes.
He comes second. So.
That's right. I think that's what you're going to see more of. I think the way that language is used on the series, the way that people are able to tell their stories, that's what's going to affect change the most.
Yes. Before we go, do you have any favorite moments that you want to share from location or anything?
I think for me, the best part of location is just, you know, when I go out and I myself am not a very adventurous person. I am not a camper by nature. I'm not coordinated. I don't do well necessarily on set, but it pushes me as a reporter to get out of my shell.
Oh my gosh. My dad was like, your idea of roughing it is like not having a TV. Why would you want to go on Survivor? I'm like, I don't know. It's cool.
No, but I think that's what is great. It pushes you as a reporter, because in order to understand what the contestants are going through, I have to do it too. And so I've loved that. I've been to some wonderful places. I've met amazing people. And I think that's it. I think there's a community that's fostered among the press as well as among the contestants. And that's been a beautiful thing. I've met so many of my own friends through being on the show. I would definitely count Dalton as one of them. Mara Reinstein. These are all reporters for rival publications at the time. But we're all good friends because of the bonding experience you get when you're out on location for Survivor.
You guys do an awesome job covering the show. And the fact that Jeff, what you cover his wedding, speaks to more than awesome job. Because he strikes me as a very private person.
He can be, but at the same time, he's generous with people. Once you get to know him, I think he trusts that when I'm covering him for stories, whether they run in People, TV Week, this book and other places, that I'm going to be truthful to the facts of the situation. And I think I don't promise that, oh, I'll be hanging out with you at your house or doing anything like that. I think he respects what reporters do. And that makes it an incredible relationship, that each time that we speak, we're going to be talking about something new about the show something new about himself that he may not know. And that's always a good relationship to have.
Who's your favorite contestant in Survivor history?
Oh, in Survivor history, I don't know. You can't go too far without mentioning Suri. You can't go too far without mentioning, in some way, Tony, who surprised me. So those probably stand out to me. Yul, as I mentioned, is extraordinary on a personal level. Earl and what he's done with his community as well. I can't say enough about the people that you meet along the way.
I would love to see someone like Suri and Jesse on the same season. That would be amazing to watch.
Wouldn't it? Are there people that you do want to see come back and how?
So I may be a little biased, but I would love to see Noelle come back without Jesse because hot take. If Jesse is not on the island, she wins the game. And right. I love Gaber. I've been in touch with Gaber and he's an amazing human being. But if Jesse is not on the island, Noelle wins the game.
Mm.
And I would love to see a quote unquote disabled winner just for the culture. So yes. Noelle and Ryan, and of course, three, those would be my top. And Jesse, because as much as I love Gaber, it sucks that a fire making competition took him out.
I think you'll allow it.
Those four are my top four.
Oh, wonderful. Hopefully we'll get to see more soon. I do know that for our advantage, they do want to have seasons with new players, new people for us to grow to love. And I think that's a really good idea to keep the pipeline going so you see people live their dreams of being on the show.
Which is awesome, because I know there are a lot of kids out there that grew up watching it that now want to play. So it would be unfair to just say, oh, we're bringing all old people back. Sorry, that would be unfair to them.
So. Oh, they want to come back. I think most people do. I think most people exit playing the game and they're like, oh, instantly, I know what I should do next time.
Yeah, because you see it from all angles when you watch it back at home and you're like, oh, it's not bad. Like.
It is. And it's, but I, like your dad, I think I enjoy the idea of watching it from the comfort of my home. Having been out there, I think it's a lot better to be indoors.
I want to go just experience it. I would love to be in production on the show, first of all, but I would love just to go to experience it just once from just to satisfy the fan in me. But yeah, it's much better when you have a bed you can go to when the show is over.
I think what you would find most interesting is just the sheer size of the production. That,
oh gosh, I was reading about that. It's there. Somebody was asking me a question about the production the other day. Not that I'm a producer, but I know a lot about it because I've been following for 20 years and want to be in production. And I'm like, oh, they're a well-oiled machine. They have everything down.
Yes, they have everything down, but it's always, you're also dealing with the elements, making sure, you know, that you're working a challenge during high or low tide that will affect, you know, the result of the challenge. You know, what if a storm is coming in, what do you do with that? You've got 20, 30, 40 people on a crew at any given point in time in a location. It's a lot to factor in. And so I think you would appreciate being out there to see all of that's to produce one moment in a show requires a lot of people.
Yes, we would need 2 plane tickets to feed you, but I think we would. I think we would definitely go get a chance. If we got a chance to go out there, that would be amazing.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully that will happen. It's definitely something to keep as a goal because it's an extraordinary production to watch. There are a lot of very dedicated people who make it happen, and in many ways, it's been wonderful getting to know them over the years.
So, do you know? And this might be a little too inside. Insider, but do you know if there's anybody with a disability on Austin? I remember Austin because they did that whole piece on Austin. But do you know if there's anybody else with a disability on the crew?
I do not. And that's probably a privacy thing, but I do know that they've been much more.
I'm not saying that. I'm just asking just out of curiosity because sure. I'm like, I wonder.
I do. But I do know that it's at any given moment, there's between 350 people to 500 people working on each season. So it's quite a lot of people, and I'm sure you'll find what you want to find on that series, in that crew.
So what, real quickly, if you don't have to go, do you have to go? I don't want to keep you long.
No, that's okay.
What other pop culture do you cover?
All sorts of pop culture. I'm learning a lot more about Australian pop culture than I'm living here. So covering TV shows and movies and musicians that live here. But yeah, any kind of program. As I said, as far as reality goes, covering Survivor Australia has been as fun as covering Survivor in the States and getting to know people out here.
That Survivor Australia airing schedule is, I don't watch any international versions of Survivor, and people joke on me, oh, you can't imagine without Jeff. I just 3 hours, like every 3 days, every 2 days. That
yes,
is-
yes. Can you imagine instead of a 26 a day experiment or 39 days as it was originally, they shoot for 50 days and 24 contestants begin. And yeah, it's incredibly intense to imagine sustaining your game for that long.
There are very few people that could do that. I don't even know if, I guess Louise doing it on Big Brother's, yes, she could, because Big Brother's 100 days, but there are very few people that could do that. Like yes. When it got to day 38, I'd be like, okay, fine. And they're like, we've got 40 days left. I'd be like, you've got to be kidding.
No, it's very different. And the mentality has to be different when you're calculating for staying that long. But I think that's what's made it very unique. Australian culture is different. They definitely value what they call mateship, which is friendship. And so you see that kind of play in where people want to be devious and sneaky, but then if you are you going against the expectation of the culture? So that's been an interesting thing to see play out. Yeah, so I'm always enjoying a chance to cover a series over here. We've got our own version of The Bachelor, of Masked Singer, all that kind of stuff. So that's been fun, but also covering movies and other TV series.
Bachelor different in Australia than it is here.
Yes, it is. I think people are much more accommodating to being inclusive of the LGBTQIA plus community in terms of Bachelor representation here. They had the first bisexual bachelorette in the history of the franchise here. I think you have a lot more openness in Australia to different experiences, which is nice.
Are you any plans to cover the Golden Bachelor, and how do you expect them to go?
No, but I'm very curious if that is something that will excite people, or people will be like, oh, I don't know about that. But I think it's nice fans that they're
not that I watched The Bachelor, but fans have been begging for it for years.
No. I think this is a nice golden age. The more people are used to reality formats, now you can expect different people to be involved. You're not restricted to what original producers may have thought would be the only pool of applicants that they could see. And it's going to improve, I think, overall. I think the impact of shows like Top Chef and Project Runway and RuPaul's Drag Race, all of them have helped other shows be more inclusive.
Which, if we're talking about a well-oiled production, no matter what you think of the show, that RuPaul's Drag Race is a so well-oiled production.
Right. They know their beats. They know what they want to cover. But again, it's casting too, because even though you have a formula that you're using, everything can change with the people who are involved. And that's what's going to endear a viewer to see a show. Can I relate, or can I learn from the people I see on television?
Yes, which I never thought I could relate to a show like RuPaul's Drag Race, but I'll be darned if at least once a season I'm not crying at the end or something. That's
the impact of a good show and the right people to tell their stories. It can make everyone empathetic and understanding of a different situation, of a different way of living. And that is the best thing that you can expect from nonfiction, I guess you can call it, television.
So I wonder if these reality TV shows, and I'm not talking about Jeff, I'm just talking about all of them. I wonder if they watch reality TV. I was thinking about that and I was like, do they watch?
I think they do. I think they appreciate their craft. I think what was interesting is Jeff told me that when he worked in New York City at the start of his career, there were two other hosts in which they were all a very tight friendship
group. Yes, and I've heard this story, and
yes,
it's amazing that he thinks, I'm going to be in the final two with Bill Kogan, and he shows up, and it's Bill Kogan. Yes.
And they're up for the same job, but then as Mark Burnett said, oh, it doesn't matter, the other one's going to get the other job. But then also in their group was Tom Bergeron, who was the longtime host of Dancing with the Stars. They were all together at the same time in New York working for Fox Breakfast, if you can believe it. And
which is that's incredible. Quite a talent.
Yes.
Basically, that's like Mount Rushmore.
of the hosts, right? That you expect. But they're incredibly supportive of each other. They know how difficult it is to run a show. And I think you see that carried through in their careers now. Really so, lovely to see that.
How is Jeff, because I cannot get out of here without talking about the Emmys that he hosted, which he laughs at himself now and says, yes, otherwise known as the worst Emmys in recent history, but he, which he says himself. So he has a very self-deprecating sense of humor. How's Jeff's relationship with Howie Mandel?
I think it's fine. I think it's since been fine. It's difficult at the moment. You're reacting to what's happening to you. I think they're fine. They've gone on to different kinds of careers. Howie has definitely now done some Netflix series.
He's on America's Got Talent now.
Yes. And
he's a totally different man than he was even back then. Because personal fact, I have a condition that's a kind of a step down from OCD called obsessive rumination that I've dealt with my whole life. Me and my dad were out at a restaurant and we were talking about it. And I said, looking back now, Forbes is my first thing I ruminated on. He's, oh no, you've been ruminating since you came home from the hospital. So I kind of know, not that it, and I don't have full-fledged OCD by any means, but I know what it's like to deal with mental health like that and how that can make you into a totally different person. So yes, if you've read his book, he played this pretty sadistic prank on this guy where he made him like cross dress as a woman, walk through a plane full of people. And yes, that was bad. And I've never done anything like that because I would feel so horrible about myself. But that is just the product of the condition. And it was before he was being treated.
He's given a lot of blessings for what has happened and his evolution in his career. And I think that's what you want to see. And there's still joy to be had in the humor that he appreciates. And it's good that he can be able to fulfill that in the projects he has now.
And I don't think that he would even think about doing something like that today, not right, just because the culture is different and there's social media now, but just because he's a different human now than sure, he was. And I don't think maybe he would, because he's on with Heidi, makes jokes about her all the time, but I don't even think he would make the sexual jokes he was making about her boobs or whatever he was doing. I don't even remember that whole Emmys because I didn't watch it all because I had school the next day. So I recorded part of it, watched part of it later. And I don't even think, one, that would be tolerated today, and two, that would even cross his mind today.
Right. Well, back then also, reality was still new enough that I think they were nervous. They wanted to be edgy and funny in a crowd of people who they knew probably didn't respect what they were doing in the same way. I think now, flash forward to now, all genre on television has established itself. And I don't think you would have the same issues. I think if Jeff were to host again, it would not be the same situation as it was before, and it would be handled completely differently.
Yes. And I would like to see him host SNL. And if you talk to him again, which I don't expect you to, and bring up me, but you can tell him that he has my permission to be as irreverent as he wants to be, and I will not be offended.
I'm sure he would appreciate it. There's still a part of him that can do cameos on programs. He has done that before, so you never know what to expect.
So do you think Jeff gets it worse than a lot of the other reality TV hosts, or is that just my perspective? Because I follow him more than I do all the other ones.
I think it's difficult when you've been in the game the longest. Then you become someone that you can people can focus on because you're a known quantity. And people think they know him because he's been on for as long as he has. So perhaps there's a little bit of that, you know, that they can adjust that. But I will tell you, so many people have learned their way of hosting from him and taken cues from him. So he's been very influential as
mine, me included. I have to say, I'm one of those.
Great. I think you'd be flattered.
Is there anything else you want to add about any pop culture in general, like Joe and Sophie news? Do you know anything about that or anything else before we get off here? Because I got to let you go. Because
that's okay. I have no new scoop for you, alas, on anything that's happening in the States. I only know a lot of what's happening immediately here in the US, but in Australia. But in general, I just think the more that you love a show, do express it, because they do hear you. They do hear the feedback. You may not seem it all the time, but they do. And that's the way you can keep the programs you love alive.
Yes. And it cracks me up when people of all shows are like, they don't hear that. They don't care that we don't like it. They care you don't like it. It's just a production budget kind of thing.
Yes, but one of the things that people always say is, oh, I would love it if Survivor went traveling again, if you were to have a series where you go to another continent, another country. As we've learned, the more places become gentrified and it's harder to find isolated spots.
And you have to establish a contract with the new government. You have to uproot sometimes entire families and say, okay, we're moving there. And it's just, no.
Like, when the show started, it was easy because you had a small crew and they were familiar with the show. They hop around.
On Rob Sestrinino's podcast, I didn't even think about this. My aide at the time was in the car with me and we were listening together because that's what we always did. And they were all single at the time and they're all married now. And I'm like, I didn't even think about that.
People's lives change and that changes how they view what they can do with the production. And I do think having established the foothold in VG, it just makes it a lot easier for them as a production. And also because the budget will be more controlled, it allows us to see the show longer, which there is that.
Okay, I hesitate to ask this question because Reddit is going to take it. And I have two more questions and then I'll wait, sure. You got, I promise. When do you think that Jeff is going to retire?
Ooh, that is a really good question. I think when he feels he can no longer be the most effective host that he can be. That's difficult. That's going to be a difficult call. But right now he's still in, I think, the best position that he can be. He's still very active and seemingly ageless.
I'm like, okay, not to sound like this in a romantic way, but how does he work out that much and then run a show and then stay in that fantastic of shape? What in the heck?
It's an island mystery. but I think, yeah, I think he would say that it's if he's in the position to deliver the best show, then he'll be around to do that.
And do you have a favorite Survivor moment and or probe story that you can share with us?
Favorite probe story? I don't know. I would just say that on location, he just is so aware of what's happening. I think one of the things that I noticed was he'll be walking on set and he'll be in his mind rehearsing what he needs to do. He's in a quiet moment. You can't bother him when he's in that phase. But once he hits his mark and he starts going, it's all of that preparation that was internal comes out and he's just super fluid, minimal takes, if not just the single take of what he has to do.
So do they ever have to retake them? Do they ever have to do another take? Have you ever seen that?
I've seen that when they want a different angle. Like for instance, at the opening of Winners at War, when he's standing and he's introducing the champagne toast,
yeah,
you know, all the contestants coming back, there's noise factors, there's positions of the drone camera factors. And so they may have to reline them up, move them to stand in a different way. But that's it. It's very minimal of an effect. Most of the time, they want to do it as spontaneously as possible. And I think that's a good philosophy. But you need to have a good host to do that. You need to have someone who everyone's looking to for those cues. And that's what you have in Jeff.
Thank you so much for coming on. I have so many more questions I want to ask you, but I don't want to keep you here for 2.5 hours. Where can people follow you on social media?
Well, you can follow me on X, I suppose that's what you call it now.
At Twitter?
At P.O. Wong, so at P.E.O.W.A.N.G. They can follow me on Instagram at Wong Brand, and that's W.A.N.G.B.R.A.N.D.
So it's Wong, not Wang.
Yes.
I should have asked you that.
You can follow me on those two places.
Thank you so much for doing this. I kept you way over the time I was supposed to, but I hope I asked good questions. And
you definitely did, Devin. I so appreciate being on and being able to share some love of the show and hopefully some knowledge for people, and just appreciate that you've been so enthusiastic about the program.
We will see you guys next episode. Bye, guys.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to follow the show and our guests on social media and subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app using the links in the show notes. Please remember to rate and review us. See you next time.